Greetings, warriors, veterans, and America-loving citizens from sea to shining sea. Welcome to Frontlines of Freedom. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Hoo-wah! The Frontlines of Freedom team really appreciate you joining us this fine day in America. We are proud Americans. Here's what we have for you this hour. We'll start by talking with Marine vet Manny Vega about training deaths in the military. Then General Chris Petty will present the Battle of the Month. And of course, we'll conclude with military history and our self-defense report. So it's a pleasure to introduce Manny Vega. Manny served a number of years in the Marines, then became a police officer. His son, following his dad's step, joined the Marines and died early on in his training. This led Manny to look too deeply into training injuries and deaths. And I don't think you'll like what he found. I didn't. Anyway, welcome, Manny. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. And thank you for allowing me to talk to you and to your audience and to share a very tragic story, but at the same time, a very troubling story that myself as a veteran, as a service-disabled veteran, and you as well, we have no clue. And I would say the majority of your audience is going to be unpleasantly surprised at what I'm about to say.
Yep. But it's one of those things that we can ignore it and it won't go away. So we've got to pay attention to that. Manny, start by telling us about your time in the Marines. When and why did you join? Where did you serve? What did you do?
Sure. I went into the Marine Corps when I was 17 years old. I grew up here in Oxnard, California. My parents came from Mexico as immigrants. They worked the fields, and basically we lived in a predominantly a Mexican neighborhood, so called the barrio. And so a lot of gangs, a lot of drugs, a lot of problems. And so trying to escape all of that, For whatever reason, I didn't know much about the Marine Corps other than watching the Sands of Iwo Jima with John Wayne. And I think that's what really put it over the top for me. And I went into the Marine Corps not really understanding what the Marine Corps was other than I needed to get away from the situation I was in. I was in the Marine Corps for about 9 years. During that time period, I was in the infantry. I was an 0311, you know, rifleman. And from there, I got selected to be a scout sniper. I wasn't looking to be a scout sniper. I other than, you know, somebody said, hey, you know, we need you to go try out for this particular assignment. And at the time, you know, physically fit, motivated, had the street smarts behind me, and I was good with all my field skills and just a good overall Marine. I successfully passed scout sniper school out in Camp Lejeune, 2nd Marine Division. And from there, I was a scout sniper. I deployed throughout the world, Middle East, Mediterranean, you know, out in the Pacific, numerous deployments, numerous involvements in different incidents. And then I this is one of those times that gets kind of funky for me in the Marine Corps, my Marine Corps history, where you know, you have some pretty bad experiences, and then those bad experiences turn into something, you know, that's called PTSD. But back in the day, it wasn't called PTSD. It was more called, you know, more being called a coward or a nonconformist and so on. So I had no idea that I was suffering from PTSD, and that kind of turned my Marine Corps career upside down.
You know, I understand. I never experienced that. Indeed, when I first heard about PTSD, after 2 tours in Vietnam as an infantryman, I thought it was made up until a majority of the guys in my platoon for my first tour and my company for my second tour said, no, Den, it's real. So I had to learn about it secondhand, but at least secondhand from a bunch of guys that I knew and trusted and loved. So you got out of the Marine Corps and ultimately you became a police officer, right?
I did. So getting out of the Marine Corps, my path of getting out of the Marine Corps was to come out here to Oxnard or along the coast. Horrible place to visit, so don't come. We sit between Malibu and Santa Barbara with some very ugly beaches. So I love fishing. I love fishing out in the ocean. And I wanted to get out of the Marine Corps and just go work as a deckhand on some of these fishing boats. That was my relief. That's where I wanted to go. I was newly married, my new bride was in agreement with that. But you know, life always has surprises for you. And in my short timer platoon, I had an individual that wanted to that wanted to do a take the police test for the Los Angeles Police Department. And so I took him from Camp Pendleton to LA to take the test. Long story short, he convinced me to take the test as well. And basically I passed, he failed. And so that's my path into the police department.
You know, isn't life full of interesting little things like that? Very few people, whatever they plan to be in high school is what they're doing now. That's very, very few people. Amazing things come along. And you stayed in the police for quite a while, right?
I did. So I did a couple of years with the LAPD. I worked Rampart Division, which back in the early 90s, boy, that was the real deal there. You know, it was like being in the movie. I mean, just the amount of violence and death and just one crazy call to the next. And I mean, it was exciting. It was troubling. I learned a lot. I thought I knew a lot. I thought I had seen dead people in the Marine Corps, but nothing like what I saw as a police officer in LA. And then being from the city of Oxnard, I was commuting every day. So it's a, you know, for those of you who live in California, Southern California, you know that from Oxnard to LA, it's about 60 minutes, 60 miles. But man, that's a hard fought 60 miles, sometimes 2 hours on the freeway. So
amen,
2 hours there, 8 hours of terror, 2 hours back. And it just wore me out. And so I finally came to work here at the Oxnard Police Department, where almost 15 years in, I destroyed my left ankle and was medically retired.
Okay. Now, somewhere along there, you had a son who wanted to be like his dad and join the Marines. Talk about him.
Sure. My son, Patrick, was born in 1997. You know, beautiful kid. Just like, you know, all of us that have sons and daughters, you know, we're nothing but proud of our kids. And so good kid, smart kid. I had a blast with my son growing up. I would lay in bed with him. And, you know, when he got old enough, we would just lay there in bed and tell stories. You know, he'd share his little story and I'd share my story. And we'd go back and forth. By the time I knew it, he passed out and go to sleep. And that was a good night, you know. And so good kid growing up, never gave us any trouble, excelled in school. You know, everything from elementary to junior high school, got into high school, did okay in high school. I figured, you know, that's where, you know, you know, even though he was a smart kid, he was, I think he was bored with high school and was looking for something else. But something with him, we got him swim lessons at the age of two, because mm-hmm. both my wife and I are always in the water. And he started swimming competitively at the age of five.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So he was a little fish. And then his sister soon came along and same thing, followed in his footsteps as far as competitive swimming. So in the early years, we did baseball, we did some basketball, but mostly swimming, competitive swimming. And so then that followed him into going into junior lifeguards. We love going into the ocean. I taught him how to surf. We'd go out there and surf and spend hours out in the ocean. That was always awesome. Just being there, catching some waves with my boy. That was some of the most memorable times of my life. In junior high school, we started playing water polo, competitive swimming, junior Olympics, got into high school, continued with all of that, became a lifeguard, was teaching swimming lessons. So good kid, you know, and just like any of us growing up, you know, you have questions, you experiment with stuff, but I don't think he was out there doing too much crazy stuff. He was always a good kid, very kind, not because he's my son, but very kind, always very respectful.
Then he wanted to join the Marines. And that's what we'll have to talk about when we come back. Clearly, Manny's going to stay with us as we continue this story. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. Troop is timed to balance on one foot for 3 minutes, then do the same thing on the other foot. Do this while thinking patriotic thoughts. Manny and I will be right back. Friends, there's not too many things I enjoy more than helping veterans and eating great beef jerky. Now I can do both. My good friends at Tango3.org and America's Best Beef Jerky use the highest quality beef to make the best jerky I've ever tasted. Trust me, I've eaten a lot. But that's not all. They give 100% of the profit to vetted veterans programs, mental health and suicide prevention. Go to americasbestbeefjerky.com and order now. And at checkout, check the Frontlines of Freedom promo code. I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. Thanks for joining us today on Frontlines of Freedom. We're continuing our conversation with Marine vet Manny Vega about military training injuries and deaths. Actually, that's where we're going. And it all started when your son joined the Marines. Tell us that story.
Sure. So my son, Patrick, like I said, wanted to follow my footsteps. From my experiences in the Marine Corps, I call it the good, the bad, and the ugly. And there was a lot of ugly in there. Saw a lot of Marine deaths, suffered through a lot, almost died multiple times. Very close to death on numerous occasions. And so my PTSD has raged, you know, for the longest. And being a police officer, you know, same thing. And so that's not the path that I wanted my son to go down. I wanted my son to achieve higher education and do something, but this is what he wanted to do. And not wanting to get in his way, I allowed him to do, obviously, he was going to do what he was going to do. And he joined the Marine Corps. He had a tough time with the run. Like I said, he was a swimmer and not so much a runner, but he was able to achieve his run time. He shipped out to boot camp at the beginning of March of 2018. And on March 23rd, I think it was a Friday going to a Saturday morning, I get a phone call at 2 o'clock in the morning telling me that my son was found unresponsive in his bed and we don't know how long he's been without oxygen and you need to get down here.
Wow.
And he had only been in boot camp for 10 days. You want to talk about just a numbing phone call, something to just, I mean, I'm waking up out of a dead sleep and hearing somebody tell me that, it just unbelievable.
Okay. We could talk about that for quite a while, but that led you to look into the fact that he wasn't a Lone Ranger in being injured and dying in training.
No. And I'll just go briefly over what happened to my son. It's unbeknownst to me, and this is a part that haunts me, my wife and I were actually down in San Diego, and we actually were on board Marine Corps Recruit Depot San Diego on Thursday, the day before he passed away. And I actually pulled up to the barracks, and I could have gotten out and knocked on the door and say, hey, you know, can I talk to my son? I'm here to motivate him. I'm sure I would have been okay. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. But I didn't. But I knew where he was at. We actually pulled up to the barracks and I decided not to. And we drove back north to Oxnard, and that's when we got the call. So it's one of those things, coulda, shoulda, woulda, but you know, life, like you said, has different plans. And you know, it's just that brief moment that you take that step to the left or to the right that changes things. So I don't know. I try not to dwell on that, but that's one of those things that happened to me. He was sick from like Monday through Friday. He had the common cold, we are told, but he was throwing up, wasn't able to hold water or food. From what I read in the investigation the last couple of days, he was to the point where he was throwing up nonstop. They gave him, your typical Motrin and anti-nausea medication.
Yep.
He was unable to stand, slurring his words, delirious. He couldn't make it through the chow hall line. They had to have two recruits help him across the chow hall line. And somebody else carried his tray. And on Friday, he was not able to eat. They actually took him out in the morning to go run around the track. And he collapsed and injured his knees and was put in the golf cart and taken back to the barracks. So I'm just giving you just the quick rundown of what I've learned. And all these things, you know, where is the adult in the room? Where is Marine Corps leadership? Where is Navy medicine at?
Yeah.
And as a former Marine, as a police officer, as an investigator, you know, I know what's going on. I'm asking questions. And basically, I get a call that my son was found unresponsive in his bed. We get to San Diego, to Balboa Naval Hospital. My son's in extremely critical condition. He's in ICU. The ICU doctor meets my wife and I, and he says the same thing. Your son was found unresponsive in his bed. We don't know how long he's been without oxygen. And his brain is so swollen that we can't get imaging. And he's at the most critical stage. And we need to talk about harvesting. And so as a former police investigator that stood on the side with the doctor and have given that notification to families of murder victims, traffic collisions, whatever, I already knew that my son was done. And when you start talking about harvesting, that's, you know, that's donation of organs. And I told the doctor, we're not going to make that decision until I get my daughter down here. At the time, she was 17, because there's no way that we are going to make that decision without her. So we told the doctor, we're going to let Patrick do what Patrick's going to do. And he lasted 36 hours on life support until his body finally gave out Sunday, March 25th, and he passed away.
Okay.
Yeah. At the time, we were surrounded by, you name it, one-star general, sergeant major. Everybody came out. And it's crazy how you remember things in critical moments. And there's certain things I remember, certain things I don't. But they were very, when I say they, the Marine Corps that was present there was very interested. Is this an infectious disease? Do we got to be concerned? These were the conversations I was hearing. And lo and behold, you know, you start taking that look, that 50,000 foot view of what the hell happened. Come to find out, like October, November, December timeframe of 2017, there was an E. coli outbreak that sickened and severely injured over 500 Marine recruits at MCRD San Diego. Of that group, there was about 20 to 30 that to this day are disabled because of that E. coli outbreak. CDC came out and almost shut the base down because it was filthy and in poor sanitary conditions. I mean, you could find all this online. At the same time, during the week that my son is passing away, out at the MCRD Parris Island, South Carolina, you have a gunnery sergeant and a lieutenant colonel that are being court-martialed for the death of a Marine recruit, Raheel Shadiki, who was basically tormented and bullied to committing suicide. So there's all these things going on. And so, I don't know about all this until 2-3 years later, but when you start looking at it, you know, you start asking these questions, you know, what's going on? Because unbeknownst to me, this is where it starts getting weird. My son dies on, like I said, Sunday, March 25th. Monday, March 26th, NCIS authors a one-page, one-paragraph memo that my son had 4 incidents of sepsis that led him to the ICU. His death was medically expected, and he died of an autoimmune condition, and his death was classified natural, no further investigation, no autopsy. And I didn't know about that till 1.5 years later. And so with the discovery of all this, I soon realized that we were not alone. As I started to dig into this deeper and deeper, I started finding other families that had deaths of loved ones while in basic training early on. And so we immediately discovered that we're not alone. And from there, we formed a group called Save Our Service Members. And we are seeking legislation to change what's called the Ferris Doctrine. The Ferris Doctrine is a 1950 U.S. Supreme Court decision that prevents active duty service members from pursuing any type of lawsuit or claim against the federal government. So that's what we're doing right now.
How can people get in touch with you and plug in and help you attack the Ferris Doctrine thing?
Sure. I would recommend, if you want to learn about the Ferris Doctrine, and I believe 99% of the veterans listening to this or dependents, former dependents, have no clue what the Ferris Doctrine is. Please take a look at our website, saveourservicemembers.org. And so that's all one big word, saveourservicemembers.org. And you could go on there and you can read Patrick's story along with other stories. There's a bio on me as well and other board members. More importantly, there's a page there called the Ferris Doctrine. Look up, read up on Lieutenant Rudolph Ferris, his service to our country. He served in World War II, participated in D-Day, and lived an exemplary life only to die in a barracks fire, and his widow, Bernice Ferris, was not able to get any type of justice.
Manny, thank you. You've suffered a lot, but you're standing up and helping others. God bless you. Thank you for your insightful, if painful, comments, and thank you for your service to our nation, especially what you're doing now. God bless you, bro.
Thank you. Likewise, I appreciate the opportunity.
Coming up next on Frontlines of Freedom, General Chris Petty will present the Battle of the Month, and we'll open our weekly mailbag. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. Troops, it's time for one-arm push-ups. Just do a dozen with each arm, twice. Then take a break, but stay in the area. I'll be right back.
HelpVet.net is here to help all veterans, active military, and families. HelpVet.net is a national help center helping the military community with their everyday needs. Whether you need a realtor, an attorney, discounted services, or information on retirement benefits, financial resources, and much more, our vast network of hand-picked qualified service providers are waiting to help you. With up-to-date military news and resources, you can find answers to all your needs at HelpVet.net. HelpVet.net. Never forget, never forgotten.
Friends, Adam here, Patria Foods, U.S. only company. Frozen fruits and vegetables straight from our dirt, not overseas. Support the U.S. farmer. When you shop at patriotfoods.com, we give back to a military family in need. We got to take care of each other, my friends. We have to. So important. 10% off patriotfoods.com. 10% off promo code FREEDOM and shop today.
Welcome back to Frontlines of Freedom. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Troops, I really do welcome your comments and questions. Contact me through frontlinesoffreedom.com or comment on Facebook. Now it's time for the Battle of the Month with General Chris Petty. Welcome, brother.
Hey, good to be back with you, Denny.
The battle for this month is Midway. It was a sea battle, a heck of a sea battle, in the Pacific during World War II, and it began on my first birthday, June 4th, 1942, though I guess the preliminary stuff was the day before that. Am I right?
Yes, you're right.
Okay, Chris, before we get into that, give us a quick review of your time in Mother Army.
Okay, I was a West Point graduate like you were. I branched aviation, went to flight school, did all the good aviation junior officer stuff, platoon leader, company commander, battalion staff. And lo and behold, I get the call to go to war at age 42 when I'm a battalion commander, and went to Iraq during the surge. And the battalion did some remarkable things during that difficult time of the war, which led to other opportunities for me. So before I knew it, I was a brigade commander. And then after a little bit of that, I became a general officer and worked at the Pentagon and NORTHCOM and commanded a NATO headquarters in Bosnia. So I really got a interesting, exciting, fulfilling career in, as you like to say, Mother Army.
Yep. And mother knows how to take care of her kids much of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's go to Midway. That was in the Pacific, and it was not just a battle. It was one heck of a battle. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, it was one heck of a battle. And as you briefly mentioned, it happened in beginning of June, so 3 to 6 June, 1942. And this was Admiral Chester Nimitz, strategically Admiral Nimitz versus Admiral Yamamoto, the head of the Japanese Imperial Navy. So it's quite a struggle between these two naval officers with their operational plan. And at the tactical level, it really was Admiral Fletcher versus Admiral Nagumo, which we'll talk about. But I always like to start with, why should we understand and know this battle as Americans? And I think, number one, it was a classic turning point battle of World War II. This, because of Midway, Japan had to revert to a defensive strategy instead of their offensive strategy that they've been pursuing for the year prior. So it was a major shift to Japan as a result of this battle. They could never recover from the loss of these four carriers at Midway. Another reason is it's really an example of the dominance of the aircraft carrier in naval warfare. So we had Pearl Harbor showing the power of the carrier, Coral Sea clearly, and then Midway. And so you're seeing the aircraft carrier as the dominant platform in naval warfare, which honestly has carried on through 80 years. I mean, it may be changing now, but it's been amazing. So, and the other thing is, it's a great example of the American style of war. So you have Nimitz issuing what we call mission orders to Rear Admiral Fletcher, you know, giving him wide latitude in how to do his mission. You've got Lieutenant Commander John Walden disobeying orders. He ends up finding one of the carriers. You got another lieutenant commander of a flight, Clarence McCluskey, following his gut to find two carriers. And also on the Japanese side, it's a classic example of how to screw up all of your advantages by dispersing your forces over vast distances and creating an overly complex operation. So those are kind of my favorite reasons for knowing this battle.
Well, certainly they're good examples of what not to do anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're ready for the overview?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. So after Pearl Harbor in December, which everyone is familiar with, Japan created a massive plan using deception and surprise and dispersed forces. And their goal was really to bring the now crippled U.S. Pacific Fleet to a final battle. And they used Midway as an objective because they knew that the U.S. would try to defend Midway. So they were going to set a trap. Now, most people know that the naval code breakers had pretty well deciphered the Japanese naval code. So it was a huge intelligence advantage for Nimitz. He had a really good idea of the overall Japanese plan without them knowing it. But he had a problem. He lost a carrier at Coral Sea in the weeks prior to Midway, and the Yorktown was damaged. So his plan was still a risky plan. He was going to be outnumbered, and he knew it. So he had to set his own surprise and trap. And miraculously, 1,400 dock workers at Pearl Harbor repaired the Yorktown in 48 hours. I mean, I can't even imagine that happening today, which is kind of unfortunate.
48 hours?
Really? 48 hours. They repaired the damaged Yorktown in the docks at Pearl Harbor. I mean, it was just really miraculous, and it upturned the battle. So Nimitz has three carriers in two task forces, Task Force 16 and 17. He sails them north to Midway to wait. So they're in position on 2 June because he knows the Japanese are coming. He's got access, like I said, overall to their plan. Now, as Yamamoto's complex plan unfolds, Admiral Nagumo, which is really his carrier strike leader, Admiral Nagumo, he sailed his four carriers towards Midway. And early morning, like 0430 hours on 4 June, he launched 108 aircraft toward Midway Island. Despite the defenses and the Marines on the island, they launch an aircraft and all that, but the island was just left in flames. So Nagumo thinks he's got an initial win. But the race was on. Nagumo didn't know the U.S. carriers were in the area. And obviously, Fletcher, who was Nimitz, tactical commander, knew the Japanese were in the area. So Fletcher's busy looking for Japanese carriers while Nagumo is kind of just focused on Midway Island and looking for other naval vessels in the area. So it's kind of this interesting cat and mouse game and race to who could find the carriers first. Now, there's lots of confusing routes with the airplanes, the flights launching from the different carriers, and I don't have time to go into that, of course. But here's the big takeaway. So as Nagumo is in the middle of recovering his Midway strike force, his carriers were attacked. And, one of the big stories of Midway is how the U.S. Navy managed to find these carriers before Nagumo knew that U.S. carriers were in the area. And they ended up attacking these carriers at their most vulnerable point. So he's recovering his Midway strike group. He's got planes that are full of fuel. He's in the middle of changing from bombs to torpedoes because now he's worried about naval ships in the area because he does have spotter planes out. And so even though Fletcher's guys find the carriers, they attack them with U.S. Devastators, which I know most of your audience isn't like naval plane, aviation experts, but the Devastators were kind of a slow-moving Buffalo kind of, and the Japanese Zeros would just take them down. So there was a lot of sacrifice made on that day by Devastators. But the moral of the story is the Devastator sacrifice actually paid off because the Dauntless dive bombers arrived overhead at the perfect moments, and the Zeros were all distracted at low altitudes fighting off the Devastators. And so these Dauntless dive bombers came out of 15,000 feet and just launched into these carriers and just set them in flames. So there's three carriers hit. And the fourth carrier remained untouched. And so now it's a race to find the fourth carrier. Like, again, a lot of confusion with the launching and recovering of aircraft and who's out there, and the Japanese end up hitting Yorktown. And after the strike group comes back, they locate another two carriers with spotter planes. They hit again. They have no idea that the U.S. has three carriers out there. They think they've got two carriers because they hit Yorktown again because it was repaired and it wasn't smoking in the water anymore. And so just a little subplot in the story where Nagumo actually still thought he had a chance. But once again, Dauntless dive bombers arrive overhead at the right time, and they put the last carrier in flames. And before you know it, the Japanese have lost all four carriers in just the 4th of June, essentially. And Yamamoto is forced to call off the whole operation the next morning. So it's just a fascinating battle. It's a cat and mouse, quick race to who can find the carriers and target them. The U.S. gets really lucky with some of the timing, a lot of the interesting subplots about, like I said, McCluskey, you know, finding the carriers by basically violating his orders or following his gut. Things the Japanese just aren't doing. You know, there's kind of a cultural change here or difference that you're seeing on the battlefield or the ocean. So it's a fascinating story. It's a great victory. It changes the entire course of the Pacific War. So that is Midway in a quick overview.
And what an amazing battle. And as you pointed out, it turned around the Battle of the Pacific.
Yeah.
Okay, this is Colonel Denny Gilliland, Frontlines of Freedom. We're talking with General Chris Petty. Chris, we're almost out of time, but take a minute and talk to us about Battle Digest.
Yeah, I hope that your listeners would take a look at my publication called Battle Digest. I take these historical battles that we should all know, and I put them into very concise, beautiful, trifold brochures that have the maps and the images. You can actually follow the sequencing of Midway, which is kind of complicated, actually, and I've done it in like 3,000 words. So it takes 30 minutes to become a, quote, expert on the battle. And I hope they take a look at my site and what I have to offer. It's battledigest.com. So real simple, battledigest.com. And you get access to these wonderful summaries of great military history.
Amen. Chris, thank you. Thank you for your service to our nation, for being a great part of the Frontlines of Freedom team, and for educating me on stuff that I should know but don't know as well as I should. I'm glad we're friends and working together.
Thanks, Denny, and thanks for your service. I'm always glad to be with you.
I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Next up is time for our weekly mailbag. Then it's military history time. You reported for duty to Frontlines of Freedom. Stand tall, troops. Let's do some more push-ups. How about 60 this time? I want your ranger ready. Then stand at ease.
From ending our nation's endless wars, to making sure veterans get the care they deserve, to addressing our country's out-of-control spending problem, Concerned Veterans for America is taking on the most important issues facing our nation. You can help CVA shape a better future for Americans everywhere. Visit cv4a.org to learn more, see how you can get involved, and join our movement. That's cv4a.org.
Do you have a story inside you yearning to come out? As a self-published author, you are free to creatively distribute your book online or using your own professional connections. White Feather Press will publish your manuscript and set up online distribution, allowing the author to retain all copyright and distribution rights as well as all profits. Check out White Feather Press at publishyourdream.com. White Feather Press, reaffirming faith in God, family, and country.
I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. This is the final formation for this week on Frontlines of Freedom. Okay, team, it's mailbag time. I really welcome comments from you, our listeners. Send your thoughts to me at denny@frontlinesoffreedom.com or on Facebook. Skip, what's the first one?
Well, Colonel, Pete and his wife, Betty, both Air Force vets, really enjoyed the anniversary show. They've only been listening for about a year and really enjoyed hearing the rest of the story.
Thank you, Pete and Betty. I appreciate your comments and support.
And Paul, a coastie, really enjoyed May's movie. That was seriously awesome.
You're right, Paul. I learned a lot from it, and I'm an old guy. Okay, now it's time for military history. What's the first one, Skip?
Well, Colonel, on 14 June 1775, Congress adopted the American Continental Army after reaching a consensus position in the Committee of the Whole. This procedure and the desire for secrecy account for the sparseness of the official journal entries for the day. The record indicates only that Congress undertook to raise 10 companies of riflemen, approved an enlistment form for them, and appointed a committee, including Washington and Schuyler, to draft rules and regulations for the government of the Army. Happy birthday, United States Army.
That's our birthday, all right. And on 14 June 1777, 3 years later, during the Revolutionary War, we adopted a resolution stating that the flag of the United States be 13 alternate stripes of red and white, and that the Union be 13 stars, white in a blue field, representing a new constellation. The national flag, which became known as the Stars and Stripes, was based on the Grand Union flag, a banner carried by the Continental Army in 1776 that also consisted of 13 red and white stripes. According to legend, Philadelphia seamstress Betsy Ross designed the new canton for the Stars and Stripes, which consisted of a circle of 13 stars and a blue background at the request of General George Washington. Historians have been unable to conclusively prove or disprove the legend, but the June 14th is now celebrated as Flag Day, as well as the Army's birthday.
And on 12 June 1862, Confederate General Jeb Stuart began his ride around the Army of the Potomac after being sent on a reconnaissance of Union positions by Robert E. Lee. 4 days later, Stuart had circled the entire Yankee force and provided Lee with crucial information. General George McClellan spent the spring of 1862 preparing the Union Army for a campaign against Richmond up the James Peninsula. By late May, McClellan had inched up the James with relatively light fighting. But after Joseph Johnston was wounded on May 31, Robert E. Lee assumed command of the Army of Northern Virginia. Lee began to show the gambling spirit that eventually earned him a reputation as one of history's greatest generals. Lee dispatched Stuart's 1,200 troopers to investigate McClellan's right flank. Stuart soon discovered that McClellan's right flank had no natural topographic features to protect it, so he continued to ride around the rest of the army. He took prisoners and harassed supply lines. They rode 100 miles, pursued by Union cavalry that was commanded, coincidentally, by Stuart's father-in-law, Philip Cook. The Confederate cavalry was far superior to their Yankee counterparts, and the expedition became legendary when Stuart arrived back to Richmond on June 15. The information provided to Lee helped the Confederates begin an attack that eventually drove McClellan from Richmond's doorstep.
And on the 15th of June, 1863, during the Civil War, President Abraham Lincoln called for help in protecting Washington, D.C. Throughout June, Confederate General Robert Lee's Army of Northern Virginia was on the move. He'd pulled his army from around Fredericksburg, Virginia, and had headed towards Pennsylvania. Lee decided on a second invasion of the North to take the pressure off Virginia and to seize the initiative against the Army of the Potomac. The first invasion in September of 1862 failed when the Federals fought Lee's army to a standstill at the Battle of Antietam in Maryland. Lee later divided his army and sent the regiments towards the Shenandoah Valley, using the Blue Ridge Mountains as a screen. After the Confederates took Winchester, Virginia, on June 14th, they were situated on the Potomac River, seemingly in a position to move on Washington. Lincoln didn't know it, but Lee had no intention of attacking Washington. On June 15th, Lincoln put out an emergency call for 100,000 troops from the state militias. Although the troops weren't needed, it showed how vulnerable they thought the federal capital was.
And on 15 June 1877, Henry Ajen Flipper, born a slave in Thomasville, Georgia, in 1856, became the first African-American cadet to graduate from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, New York. Flipper, who was never spoken to by a white cadet during his 4 years at West Point, was appointed a second lieutenant in the all-African-American 10th Cavalry, stationed at Fort Sill in Indian Territory.
And on the 13th of June, 1944, Germany launched 10 of its new V-1 rockets against Britain from a position near the Channel coast. They were much less than devastating. The V-1 was a pilotless, jet-propelled plane that flew by air-driven gyroscope and magnetic compass, capable of unleashing a ton of cruise missile explosives. The detonation process was imprecise, depending upon the impact of the plane as the engine quit and the craft crash-landed. Of the 10 V-1 flying bombs shot at England, 5 crashed near the launch site, 1 was lost altogether, just 4 landed inside the target country, only 1 managed to take 6 lives.
And on June 16, 1961, during the war in Vietnam, an agreement was reached for direct training and combat supervision of Vietnamese troops by U.S. instructors. South Vietnamese President Diem had earlier asked Kennedy to send additional U.S. troops to train the South Vietnamese Army. U.S. advisors had been serving in Vietnam since 1955 as part of the U.S. Military Assistance Advisory Group. There would be only 900 U.S. military personnel in South Vietnam at the end of 1961. But in accordance with Kennedy's pledge to provide American military assistance to South Vietnam, the number of U.S. personnel rose to 3,200 by the end of 1962.
And a lot more after that. And that's military history for today. Now it's time for the self-defense report. Take us there, Skip.
All of us here at Frontlines of Freedom believe strongly in your right to keep and bear arms for protection of yourself and your family. All across the country, violent crime is skyrocketing. And now more than ever, Americans need to stand up and exercise their Second Amendment rights. Now is the time to get trained and ready to handle this growing threat. But if you're not, please look into it and learn what you can do to legally carry a firearm to protect the ones you love. What's the story this week, Colonel?
Well, a man in Deltona, Florida, let his dog, Winston, a chocolate Labrador, out into the backyard as usual around dinner time on March 5th. He saw Winston behaving a little differently than usual, so he went over to see what the dog was interested in. The homeowner saw an alligator at the same moment the alligator noticed the dog, and they both lunged forward with the alligator clamping down on Winston's head. The man shot the alligator 4 times in the skull, killing it. My heart just dropped, and I was like, okay, I've got to do something, the homeowner told reporters. So, I mean, you just spring into action and do what you have to do to save your dog. You know, 20 seconds later, I probably would have had a dead dog. Winston suffered only a puncture wound in the ear, and no charges were brought against the quick-thinking owner.
Thanks, Colonel. I did a little research on this just to see if alligator attacks were a valid threat, and here's what I found. According to the Florida Wildlife Commission, there have been 401 documented alligator bites in Florida since 1948, and 23 of those were fatal attacks. Statistics from the Florida Wildlife Commission show an increase in the number of alligator bites suffered by humans since gators came off the endangered species list in 1987. Realistically, the chance of being attacked by an alligator are incredibly low, 1 in 3.2 million. So you have to ask yourself, what's the big deal? Well, I guess it's not a big deal until you're attacked by an alligator. Take, for instance, in February 2023, an 85-year-old woman was killed by a 10-foot-long alligator while walking her dog by a pond near her home in Fort Pierce, Florida. A neighbor videotaped the entire attack. I watched this one, and it was sad as we listened to the neighbor scream in terror as the old woman was pulled into the pond and disappeared. Then in March 2023, a Daytona Beach man was bitten by a 9-foot alligator, and in May 2023, a 23-year-old man was attacked by a 10-foot alligator outside a bar in Port Charlotte, Florida. In March 2023, a man in Daytona Beach was sent to the hospital after being bitten on the leg by an alligator. So, in that regard, it's like any other unfortunate event in your life, like a mugging or a rape or a murder. It's not really a big deal, so long as it's happening to someone else. The bottom line is this. Gator attacks in Florida have increased by 40%, and as the animals grow larger, increase in number, and lose their fear of humans, the number of attacks will continue to rise. So, what can Floridians do to protect against alligator attack? Here are a few common sense ideas. First, never feed an alligator. It's illegal and dangerous and just stupid. Second, keep a safe distance or avoid areas known to have alligators. Third, swim only in designated areas during the daylight. And finally, don't take your pet for a walk down by the pond. You see your pet as a loving companion, but an alligator sees it as an appetizer. And guess who's the main course? Well, that would be you. The man in this week's story did a great job responding to the life-threatening attack on his dog, and Frontlines of Freedom commends him on his bravery and quick thinking. Alligators are just one more reason to get trained and get armed.
Wow, you mean there's actually a downside to living in Florida?
Yes, that's about it, though, Colonel.
That's about it. Our movie of the month is A Homeless Teen Meets a Deafblind Man Who Changes His Life Forever. It's cool. You can go to the Frontlines of Freedom website, go to the blog, get the link. You can watch it for free. We'll review it at the end of the month, and I'd really appreciate getting your comments about it. Send them to me at denny@frontlinesoffreedom.com. Next week on Frontlines of Freedom, Colonel Nate Sassman will discuss his book, Warrior King, on his time in combat. Then he and I will discuss how not to win wars. You know, we're sort of doing that right now. And Michael Vickers will discuss his book on special ops, By All Means Available. Our book, Frontlines of Freedom, with 19 authors, has the mission of helping all patriotic Americans step up and help our nation return to our traditional values of serving, not being served, of being in shape physically, mentally, and morally, of being proud of our nation. And now it's available in Spanish. You can purchase the book at frontlinesoffreedom.com. Please help us get this call to action book into the hands of all Americans.
Thank you, friends, for joining us for Frontlines of Freedom today and every week on this great station. Please check us out on Facebook and add your comments. And if you missed any part of this show, hey, all our shows are available on demand at frontlinesoffreedom.com. We especially thank our military listeners for serving our country with honor and dignity and for keeping us all safe. God bless you and your families as you serve.
I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Thank you, listeners all across America, for joining us in the foxholes on the front lines of freedom. Stand tall, be proud, Americans, and join me next week for military and veteran information you will not get anywhere else on the front lines of freedom. Dismissed.